Random family, love, drugs, trouble, and coming of age in the Bronx is the Leonard Lopez Show Book Club's first selection for 2014. Adrian Nicola Blank spent years with an extended family to create a portrait of poverty and the ways that drugs, prison, and teenage pregnancy shaped their lives. It received high praise when it was published in 2003 and remains as relevant and important today, a decade later. I'm very pleased that Adrian Nicola Blank could join us now to talk about her book. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
And we know that listeners have been reading it. If you would like to join in the conversation, our number here is 212-433-9692, or you can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. How did this story begin for you? How did you meet and start writing about these people?
I was a young freelancer in the city and working on a series of stories for the Village Voice about the drug business and what was going on. It was in the late 80s, and there was a lot of stories and interest in stories about crack and sort of the street-level dealing that was going on. And it was through meeting some young people that had been arrested for drug dealing that I began to meet family members and spend time in the state courts.
But I assume you didn't realize you're going to be spending
so much time. No, I didn't.
It seems like you must have been living with people at times. Were you?
There were times that I spent the night with the people in the book, and it really chronologically follows the trail of my education about all the interrelated issues that came from the initial reporting on drug dealing. So as much as I had no idea how long it would take me to, I wasn't writing a book when I started, but each next step was an attempt to try to make sense of what I was witnessing in very isolated ways.
And although it started off talking about drug dealing, you wind up with teen pregnancy and other criminal activities,
yes,
homelessness, and trying to get medical help and all sorts of other things, because they're all interrelated?
Yes. I mean, I think I see it, I guess, at the end of the experience, I see it as it's a story about an extended family in poverty who are trying to navigate their way through these kinds of social forces alongside all the other things that we all sort of do in our lives. But I do think they're interrelated because the kids that were in the criminal courts tended to come from certain neighborhoods. Those neighborhoods were poor neighborhoods that had suffered all the worst social problems that the city had, and once they ended up in the prison system, their own children were likelier to have those same problems. So it was a sort of a series of seeing the same people in the same places time and time again.
One generation following another. No lessons seem to be learned. Well, can you describe what this neighborhood in the South Bronx was like when you started spending time up there? And has it changed at all?
Well, I would say that I do actually think lessons are learned, in part because if you look at the if you take even the single family that I spend time with, if you look at the age at which the young woman became pregnant, even from their great grandmothers to their own age, they get older. You know, that one of the young women, her great grandmother, had her first child when she was, I think, 14, and she had her first child at 17, and her own children haven't had children yet now. So,
are you talking about Jessica?
Coco.
Oh, Coco.
And so I think, but you have to sort of look at it. There's a big difference between 14 and 17, and then obviously there's a big difference between 17 and 23. But the neighborhood when I started had a lot of visible street-level drug dealing. I mean, I remember one of the first times I went to the Bronx, getting off the train, I think in the St. Ann's area, and there were just, you could see, you know, it was sort of, people describe this, that was a lot of, it was like a drug bazaar. There was just lots of people crowded around buildings, and that's changed.
And no police presence?
There was a police presence, but it was more a kind of a drill where the police would sort of pull up, people would scramble, they would disperse, the police would hang around, they would leave, people would come back out. It had a kind of rhythm to it.
You begin with the story of Jessica. How did you meet her?
I met Jessica in the courtroom of her then partner, whose street name was Boy George, and he was on trial a federal...
Not the rock singer.
No, no. He was on a federal charge of drug dealing. They were applying the conspiracy laws that had been successful in mob prosecutions, and they were trying to use it with people in drug sort of drug businesses. So she was one of his girlfriends, and it was a lengthy trial, and I was there much of the time, and we met in the courtroom.
She's quite good looking.
Beautiful. Very beautiful girl.
And was that a reason that she got pregnant as a teenager by, well, she got pregnant a number of times,
mm-hmm.
but, or is, would that not really matter? I guess it was a reason that she was attached to this drug dealer who had a lot of money.
Her life was circumscribed in the sort of ordinary ways that a young girl with living in poverty, you know, her life would be, meaning that school, she had a lot, the most of the kids I met had already sort of left school by the time I met them. And so they're already in a certain, you know, a certain series of things are not going to happen if you leave school early. She's an incredibly beautiful girl, but also really, her relationships were a primary focus, as they are in most people's lives. But I think the reason that she probably got pregnant young, if it could be reduced to a reason, would have more to do with the lack of, I mean, a lot of young girls get pregnant, but whether they decide to have children or not has to do with other things that they can do with their lives. And I think in her case, it was a combination of the relationships, her opportunities, her desire to have children, and, you know, issues around birth control, all of that.
And there is a desire to have a child?
Sure. I mean, I think...
At a very early age. The boy who was the father of her first child never admitted that it was his baby.
Mm-hmm.
Teenage pregnancy is a fact of life in this book. Can you explain the dating culture in the South Bronx community in the 80s and 90s when you were reporting this book?
I don't. I guess the thing that I – maybe if I could try to answer it this way, it's – I sort of assume that all of these desires, you know, to be in a relationship, to have a partner, perhaps to have a child, all of these are sort of ordinary things, and they come into people's lives at certain times. What I was trying to understand is why they were happening at a time when they could they would raise the stakes for so many other things not to happen. So if you have a child at 16, a lot of things aren't going to happen. And why is that the choice that's being made? But I think the reason that the book took so long was because at each turn in the road, even the questions that I might think to ask became irrelevant because the context kept weighing down the ability to isolate the dating as an issue or the pregnancy as an issue. So I think the best answer I could give would to say that the dynamics of the context shut down a lot of options, but they're not in the same way. Most people aren't making rational choices in love relationships. But I think that in that context, romance and boys and the drama around relationships, as with a lot of teenagers, are very central. And in that case of a place that's heavily, you know, very Catholic, where there's no birth control, where there's a lot of...
With sex education in the school?
Well, they weren't in school anymore, most of them, but non-existent.
The teenage boys who fathered these kids didn't usually take any responsibility for them, and they often had children with a number of different girls. So who raised the children? Were the babies raised mostly by the grandmothers?
Yes, and there were, you know, vast extended family networks, aunts and grandmothers, and the young women themselves, but in the context of being at home where their mothers were also supportive in the child rearing.
You write about a woman named Milagros throughout the book, but at a distance. When we first meet her, I think she's a friend of Jessica's boyfriend's other girlfriend. How is it that she ends up raising all of Jessica's kids? Jessica has, what, 5 kids in all? 2 sets of twins?
By the end of the time that I reported, yes. Well, one thing that I have to say about Milagros, and I remain deeply grateful to her for this, is that she was one of the people who, there are people that, you know, you meet and agree to be part of a project, But what happened is when Jessica, during the course of the reporting, ended up going to prison herself, and her children stayed with Milagros. She was a very close friend, and she's a very responsible and strong person.
Although she's not a saint, she still seems right. to be incredibly generous.
She is. But so once Jessica was in prison, the story then involved her children, but they weren't in her care, and she allowed me to continue to report on that situation. So I was careful not to really sort of try to I was very grateful to be able to spend time with the kids, but I was also aware that she didn't really choose to be central to this project. But I think if I had to say why she did it, I just think she's one of those people who couldn't not do it, if you know what I mean. That these children needed a place to go. She loved them. She was good friends with Jessica, and she's done that for other people as well, not only for Jessica's kids.
Now, why did Jessica wind up going to jail? Boy George was the drug dealer. He was arrested after the FBI had bugged his apartments, tapped his phones. They had a lot of information about him, and I'm assuming that you saw some of the transcripts.
Yes.
While you were working for the book. But what did was Jessica deeply involved in the drug trade along with him?
She was sent to prison because she had been caught on a wiretap relaying a message about a street meeting, meaning that Boy George called in and said, could you please tell so-and-so when he calls that I'll be on this corner instead of that corner?
And that's enough to get you sent to jail?
Well, it was under the conspiracy laws, and the reason
why... That's RICO?
Yeah. The reason she ended up doing 10 years was because if you are in any way involved in the conspiracy, you're responsible for the amount of drugs that were transacted in that enterprise. So it just so happened that particular meeting involved a certain amount of drugs that... But she certainly, it's as you can imagine, if your partner is involved in a drug business, it's a hard thing to not in some way be aware of. But she wasn't directly involved in a lot of the actual business.
Well, 10 years seems a bit long for this. Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc, her book, Random Family, is the Leonard Lopate Show Book Club selection for the first one for 2014. And we are inviting your calls. You can also write us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. We have gotten a few things sent to us, and I'll be reading them when we come back, but we're going to take a little break right now. Stay with us. We're back with Anna Nicole LeBlanc, who has been a frequent contributor to the New York Times Magazine and other publications. And her book, Random Family, Love, Drugs, Trouble, and Coming of Age in the Bronx, was a National Book Critics Circle Award finalist and a New York Times bestseller, now available in paperback from Scribner, and this month's choice for the Leonard Lopate Show Book Club. We've been talking about Jessica. Her brother Cesar is another important figure in this book. What was he like when he was young?
When I first met him, he was what I guess the expression would be really out there, meaning that he was really sort of a very tough young kid who was running the streets and up to no good. And I next met him after he'd been arrested and incarcerated, and the majority of our relationship really occurred when he was in prison, and he really grew over the period of time that I knew him. And in terms of his own self-will to develop himself in ways that were more constructive, he was part of a program that Bard College had in one of the prisons he was in, where he was able to get a degree, and he was transformed by that experience.
But earlier, it's through him that you meet Coco. They are
very much in love.
He's met her when she was 14, and she winds up becoming a major
yes.
focus of this book. She had two babies with Cesar, as well as babies with other men. Was he a better father than some of the other guys?
He's proven to be a very devoted father in ways that are especially hard, obviously, if you're incarcerated. But yes, he's a very devoted father. I think I don't feel so comfortable judging the other men. I didn't know them that well. They certainly weren't present in the lives of their kids. So on that scale, I guess they're not actively involved. But I can't say they didn't care for sure.
Well, what was it about Coco that captivated you so much? The book becomes about her and her struggles.
We really enjoyed one another. She had a lot of natural energy. She's a curious person. She's very open to exploring her life in collaboration with me. And I think probably in retrospect, one of the reasons was because she is a sort of naturally upbeat person, and the actual experience of the reporting often was really hard and depressing and aroused a lot of anger in me. And I think Coco was, I'm not sure I could have actually survived a lot of the reporting with any kind of clarity sometimes if it hadn't been for her.
She tries to maintain some relationship with Cesar, but he's in various prisons. It's not always so easy. And then she has these kids which she's raising herself. And that's a point of pride for her. She bounces around from her mother's house to Cesar's mother's house. But in order to qualify for public housing and live on her own, she has to become homeless. Well, what does that involve?
At the time, the easiest or the quickest route to securing an apartment so you could live independently and actually, because overcrowded housing was a chronic problem in so many of the families that I met during the reporting, but the quickest route was to become homeless because then you were put at the sort of top of the list, whereas if you were living with your mother and you applied for public housing, it could take you, 10 years to get a house.
But in either case, you have to learn how to deal with the bureaucracy.
Yes.
And it sounds like that can be a full-time job in
itself. It is a full-time job, and recently when I read Andrea Elliott's series in the Times about the young girl Dasani and her family in the homeless shelter, I have to say I was so enraged by the clear evidence that so little had changed in the time since I'd done some reporting on homelessness. I certainly didn't do that extensive amount, but I was really devastated by that series.
The Invisible Child series.
Yes.
Because I'm sure it reminded you in some ways of what you were seeing 20 and 30 years ago.
Yeah, it did. And I think, I don't know, I guess it takes any journalist a long time to get up to speed on a subject of any kind. And I thought to myself, how many, when people were talking about the series and there was a lot of response to it, as there should have been, but I just thought, how many more times do we need to have this moment of revelation for this kind of information, which it seems like every decade or every 5 years or whatever it is. And I felt anger, I guess, is the stage that I'm at still with it.
Coco winds up moving up to Troy, New York. Why Troy? Are they better in dealing with the homeless?
Well, some people from her neighborhood had moved north because of jobs, and people would go to visit. They would leave the city and go to visit. And she wanted to go because there were better opportunities for housing, and the housing itself, the quality of it was better. There was, the homes had a yard. She heard that the schools were better, that there was still more control over the student population, and she also knew people that lived there. So all of those reasons sort of drew her to go there.
But she almost loses her place in public housing because she has a boyfriend who's living with her. You're not allowed to live with somebody?
Well, he had some issues with a criminal history, and there was a lot of concern in Troy to keep drugs out of public housing, and so that was part of what was made his presence problematic. But you aren't allowed to have an unmarried permanent male guest in your home.
Coco doesn't want to leave her girls alone with anyone who's not family because young girls are often sexually molested. Can you talk about sexual abuse and how it's affected the women and the children that you were writing about?
I worry greatly about how to describe it out of the context of the time, I guess. I feel the statistics on sexual abuse. It's not like particularly dense in this population, to the extent that I know the demographics of it. But I think the damage of sexual abuse had a lot to do with why the women's investment in being good parents was so keen. And I think that it were their kinds of therapeutic supports and supports for family engagement that some of those issues could have been processed in different ways.
Well, in many cases, the mothers don't even know when it happens or who's responsible for it. Jessica, getting back to her, she's been in prison, and then she served those 10 years or so. Did she change as a result? We hope that prison will change people for the better.
Well, I definitely think prison changes people. It's an enormous challenge for it to change you for the better, just because it's a place of such negativity and destruction. But I think it did change her feeling about her priorities, and she also, she's very devoted to her family, and I think in that regard, placing them at the front of her concerns is a significant
change.
But
toward the end of the book, there's a 16th birthday party for Serena, Jessica's oldest child, and Jessica's wary about Serena's boyfriend. You write that Serena would become pregnant within 6 months. So the process, to some degree, continues. We have a call from Maria from Manhattan. Hi, Maria. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks so much. I actually just wanted to ask Ms. LeBlanc, did you feel as though this piece was kind of an advocacy journalism? I'm speaking to the observations you made about reading about Dasani, which is, what role does journalism play in how we understand our social environment and the changes that we want to make?
I think, I don't know if consciously at the time it was a piece of advocacy, but I think my experience since the book, publishing the book, and my experience in talking about the book makes me hope that it could be. I think, but the thing that I'm always struck by, and it may be just because I'm paying attention to the part of the profession I'm in, is that whenever pieces of journalism like this come out, for example, with the Time series, there's a tremendous amount of interest in the relationship the journalist has with the people involved. And I'm very worried about that as a sort of focus of where the attention goes, because so little attention is given to a thorough discussion of the evidence of poverty. And it's another way to personalize something that actually is about structural inequality. So I'm always trying to figure a way to change the conversation.
Do you think part of the problem is that so many people are ambivalent about how to deal with poverty? We have politicians who pretty much blame the poor for their own conditions. Others say, well, Sonia Sotomayor came out of this neighborhood and she's now on the Supreme Court. Why can't these people do something similar? Why can't they live better lives?
Yeah, I think at best it would be ambivalence. I think more often it's actually a real need to disconnect from our common humanity. Because if you assume that there is a shared humanity, so many of the questions we tend to ask about the lives of people who live in poverty wouldn't make any sense. So I'm always trying to figure out. I mean, I thought what I was doing when I wrote the book was writing a book that it showed in detail how difficult it is to be poor, and also didn't make the value of caring about poor people based upon their perfectionist people, because there's a long tradition in poverty literature of very admirable poor people, and I just wanted to write about people that were sort of regular and lived their lives, made mistakes, fell in love with the right guy, the wrong guy, whatever, but that it really wasn't about that issue. And what it turned out, not always, but sometimes I realized when I would speak in public about it, is that what I'd done was to show people that poor people were actually human. And that was a really disturbing and confusing thing to realize, that people, I think, in some way dissociate from that very basic fact.
Well, you really show the day-to-day struggles of poverty and the instability that makes change so hard for people like Coco. And the people you're writing about make some very bad decisions. They have kids they can't support. They trust people who let them down. They have bad relationships. They have to deal with domestic abuse, drug abuse, sexual abuse, poverty, the bureaucracy. But your book shows how hard it is for them to lift themselves out of their bad circumstances. There's so much that's working against them all the time. Is that something that you also wanted to get across here?
Yes. I mean, certainly that there's so much that's working against them. And also to try and by contextualizing the ways in which there's a dynamic of all these things going on, that I'm not such a great believer that so much of our lives are directed by rational choice. I mean, that assumes a certain level of agency and also a confidence in causality that is not usually the experience when you're at the mercy of forces that are so much bigger than you are. It's very improvisational poverty, and I think that's very different from making rational choices. But the only way to understand that is to have a sense of how it feels to be sort of at the mercy of what's going on in a particular day.
We don't have much time, but I wanted to sneak Michelle from New Rochelle in here. Hi, Michelle.
Oh, yes. Hello.
Could you make it quick?
Yes. My only comment was in reference to the ambivalence, in reference to people from poor communities reaching other higher levels. I think a lot of the time they're just not aware of what's available, what's out there. I think in the case of Boy George, I enjoyed the book immensely. He was brilliant. I thought, you know, if he could have applied that to his studies or something, he would have been a wonderful businessman. So I think what happens in poor communities is they're emulating what they're seeing as opposed to even realizing what's available in the world. I think their perspective is so small.
Didn't the series The Wire also show that? Some of those kids were brilliant. They just were brilliant doing things that were awful.
And what was so masterful about that was there was a way that, you know, the show made the city as much a character in that drama as people in their personalities.
So Helene left a comment on our show page. She says their children go on to recreate the same conditions for the children they are equally unprepared to raise. What kind of intervention can mitigate three generations worth of constant turmoil?
Well, I would, again, have to disagree that they've actually emulated the same situation, because there have been, I mean, all of Coco's kids have graduated from high school. Her eldest daughter is a parent by choice and in a situation that is where the child can thrive and has all the, you know, has a home and financial support. So there's been a lot of improvement. But I also think one thing to always remember is the age at which these things are happening, and to encourage thinking about what one is able to perceive poor or not at 13, 14, 17, 18. And there are a lot of really great interventions that do work. They just are always in, you know, chronic need of support. I mean, that's as is going on in the conversation with our new mayor, is that what, you know, how can we sustain support for the things that work to make the city a place where people can do well?
Well, is there also just a matter of education here? Because the book got fabulous reviews. It was a bestseller. And yet we still hear the same arguments against the poor.
It's absolutely, I mean, education would be the main thing.
Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc, her book Random Family was the subject of this month's Leonard Lopate Show Book Club. It is available now in paperback from Scribner. Thank you so much
Thank
for
you.
Being with us.
Thanks for having me.